what I want to do, which I discovered before, after dinner, is violently controversial to some of even my longest term associates in this, is to now move into, for about 15 minutes, into groups of four, foursomes, because I want to place you with three other people, and my friends are going to give numbers, so we're going to have these little groups, and you're going to be there for 15 minutes with four people. You don't have to talk. If anybody truly doesn't want to talk, you don't have to. The other three can talk, and you can be a listener. You may have observations, you may have experiences, you may have thoughts, you may have questions, and an attitude of listening to one another rather than arguing or questioning is a good, so listening to one another is good, and a chance, I wanted each of you to just bring out whatever, including wisdom that's here in the room, that there hasn't been time for everybody to talk, and we'll just see how that
When we're done with that, will we come back and will we bring it back?
Not necessarily in terms of the time.
Okay,
no.
Before we do that, I would just like to bring up another question.
Good.
First of all, thank you. I think you've done... I'm sorry we waited so many years to have you.
Well, I'm often raising my hand and saying, hey, you know, at different moments.
But I think Sarah's done a wonderful job in helping us to be more realistic. Self-accepting.
Yeah.
And if you didn't know this already, that the basic principle that we've tried to communicate is to observe ourselves without judgment.
Yeah.
Through awakening presence, to come to know ourselves and not to judge what we see, because if we judge what we see, we're not going to see at all. So this is something we've tried to communicate for 40 years. But nevertheless, it doesn't get communicated every day, every week.
Well,
it
also
retreat.
It's easier said than done, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's doing it. That's what's challenging.
Yes.
When the judgment is just like...
But I want to talk about something in the Sufi teaching that I think is very important, can also be misunderstood and misused, but is also potentially a great blessing, and that is astaghfirullah. You know, that I would say that, and I saw this from my very first days in a real dervish environment. I remember going up to a dervish who I really respected and saying something nice to this person, really meaning it, and his response was simply, astaghfirullah. Okay? And that shocked me, that he would say, may God forgive me. I don't think it was an act. I think it was a way of saying, however you may praise me, I'm well aware of my own incompleteness and my own inner reality. And may God forgive me for all that, and let me not feel pride in being complimented. Something like that. But that astaghfirullah can be overdone, can be misused. But it is kind of a safeguard in our practice, I think, because it reminds us again and again and again not to shame ourselves, not to live with guilt, but to recognize our finiteness, our limitations, our human weaknesses, but also to know that there's this power in the nature of reality, Ya Ghafur, the power of forgiveness, that we need to know. We need to know that this divine attribute is the forgiving quality of the one who loves to forgive. Of all those who are forgiving, the divine is that power which forgives more than any human being can. And so there's a relationship that's established on a cosmic level, really. Now, granted, again, you may hear the words, it may take time for this to become real, but it's there. There are three stages of forgiveness. There's Ghafar, with double F, meaning the one who continually forgives and forgives and forgives, because we need that continual forgiveness. then eventually it may reach a stage of a Gafur, which means the most forgiving, not the continually forgiving, but the most forgiving of any who forgive. It means we've reached the essence of that forgiveness. We've experienced it through knowing that attribute of the divine. And the third level is al-afu, which is the forgiving power that not only forgives, but erases the fault as if it had never existed. Like the wind erases footsteps in the sands of the desert. So, I don't know, Sarah, would you like to comment or anything about this?
Well, it's just reminding me about the power of divine names, there are those, but also some of you know The Physicians of the Heart, this book that talks about a lot of the divine names. There are some names like Rahim, and Ra'uf is presented as a very supportive, loving, warm, delicate name that can hold us in our pain. And working with these names can be very wonderful this way. It's just to bring it as part of the prayer. But the stuff that's like, help me bridge this separation, and remembering the mercy. The antidote is there for all of our feelings of inadequacy and self-hate, self-shame. You know, the antidote is there if we just ask.
Yes.
It's really
very much in the forefront of the teaching, although, like many things in the forefront of the teaching, it may take us years to see that it's right there all the time. But it's built into the whole system. It's and just to repeat, I would say, we're encouraged to recognize and be honest about our weaknesses, our frailties, our imperfections, our mistakes, our wrongdoings. We're encouraged to recognize that, and what allows us to recognize it is our trust in the divine mercy and love. This is really fundamental. And also, you mentioned calling out in our need, that we're also taught this, and I'll read something tomorrow from Shems that reminds us of that, that this is one of the most powerful, acts and remedies for the human condition, is to know that we have a right to call out in our need, particularly in our suffering with our own stuff, that we make a direct appeal to the divine. So all of this is very much built in.
It is. It's all there in theory. It's all there. And I was also thinking that our relations with each other, the fact that we are all equal in the circle, that we appreciate each other, that we are these positive mirrors to one another's humanity, is a positive thing. I mean, I remember there was an exercise you did once where, years ago, like you line up and you kind of move down the line and you look at one person and you look at the next person and you look at the next person, and we'd been together all weekend. Like now, everybody's face is open. I mean, around this room, everybody is looking very wonderful, and I sort of got it. I thought, oh, I must look that way to people. You know, we see one another's beauty in our circles, and then we are seen that way, and slowly over time that helps too.
Microphone for Patsia.
If I remember correctly, that exercise was sit in front of a totally realized human being. And gaze upon this totally realized human being. And of course, there's another one in front of you looking back at you. And that was, oh my God, I'm the one. And it was like,
sorry to say, but
Kabir sitting there going, wow, you know, in front of me, wow. There was no astaghfirullah. It was just like, you know, just, oh.
I see, the way I phrased it was that look into the face of another, like I look into the face of Sarah. And if Sarah were a completely enlightened, realized being, she would look exactly like this. So look on every person as if they are that enlightened being with everybody.
Okay. Yes. Well, here's the conflict. Because we could, I told somebody when I used to teach lecture classes years ago, I would take questions and there'd be like 15 questions. Or I would say, turn to your neighbor and talk for 3 or 4 minutes, and then at the end of that there will be no questions. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it was my idea to not sit here and have questions and answers past this point,
but to be
in these little groups.
Could you take one?
Take one. No, ask a question. Okay.
I'm just wondering, you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of need?
Yes.
I was just wondering where in that hierarchy our practices fall.
Well, the hierarchy of needs, he's talking about what humanly we need. And we need security, and we need stability, we need intimacy, and then eventually we also need wholeness and spirituality. The idea here would be that many of us have deficiencies in our sense of security, and we don't feel very secure internally or feel very good about ourselves. And so those needs need to be addressed. I think he was wrong, because the spiritual needs coexist with those. It's not like you don't get any spiritual longing until you are feeling stable and secure. I think it's more correct to say we have all those longings. We have a longing for intimacy and a longing for stability and security, and a longing for, those of us who are here, have a longing for a spiritual things too.
I came from a culture and a family that was very dysfunctional. If you go to the Middle East or any countries around the Middle East, everybody's sort of chained together. Everybody cares about what everybody does. Everybody mm-hmm. wants to change everybody's life. It's not that easy to live. So
we call it, the concept is as a familial self. I mean, it's like this right. One big self is what you're talking about.
Yeah, so
everybody.
you don't have no freedom to really choose. People choose for you, people mm-hmm. choose your vibes, people choose your life, like your lifestyle. And you're always like being pointed at. Anyways, right. I practice a lot. My family practice a lot, my society practice a lot. And when I moved to the U.S., I figured out that I got more familiar with psychology and started taking therapy. I started taking a couple of classes at college, just familiarizing myself with what this psychology is, because I wanted to know what human is so I can practice better, become a better human being. And I realized after taking therapy and pills and stuff for a while that a lot of my spiritual practices wasn't really a spiritual practice. And rather, it was just a cure to that weakness that I have because of the bad culture and the society mm-hmm. and the dysfunctional family. So it wasn't really raising my status as far as spirituality. It was just bringing me to zero, basically. So psychology, basically taking therapy and pills and stuff, helped me become a person that is now capable of elevating his soul through a spiritual practice.
Beautiful, beautiful.
So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. And very good.
Yeah.
Right on. It's not your version of it is the emergence from your kind of family and culture, but that thing of becoming a person first, or you know, that allows a different kind of spirituality is true for everybody. Thank you. Say something. Yeah.
Let's, Brian, wait for the microphone.
Yeah. After that, we'll have these groups. And I want to say about the groups also. But.
Is this on?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I've spent a lot of time exploring the regions that you're talking about today. And one of the things that I've learned in practicing psychotherapy and particularly transpersonal psychotherapy is that, somebody that asked me for a referral, I couldn't take that person on myself because we knew each other too well. So he asked me for a referral, and I gave him one to a Jungian analyst. And he reported to me some time later that he really appreciated this, the work that he was doing, because there seemed to be this seamlessness. between the psychological and the spiritual dimensions of the work. Mm-hmm. And I really feel that that's where I think we have a lot of contributions to make. And those of us who are committed to a spiritual path and who are also being trained as therapists. The second thing that seems really important to me is that, and why I think this idea is about the seamlessness of the two is really important, is because my learning has been that there's an old esoteric axiom, which is the light of truth brings the darkness to the surface.
Yeah,
right on. Okay, right on. It's a slight the light of truth or the light. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but something like that. The light of truth brings imperfection to the surface, meaning that when you do spiritual practice, your psyche is going to be activated.
Yeah, right on.
Thank you. Stuff is going to start coming up.
Yes.
And that's not something that's bad. That's a part of the path.
Thank you.
And Evelyn Underhill, in her book Mysticism, tells us the first step is the stage of awakening, but the second stage is the stage of purification. And she didn't mean, brushing our teeth and like brushing our psyche. She meant that the stuff is going to come up for us to look at and for us to create an openness there so we resolve those issues. And so, I think that what Wellwood was pointing to that I think was really important is that people were doing all these spiritual practices, all these Buddhist practices, all this stuff was coming up, but they were going more and more to the meditation cushion and weren't really dealing with the stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think what I have to offer. But the second thing that I wanted to ask, I'm not really sure what this group is, what you want us to do in the group.
Okay. In the group, there's talk about alchemical transformation. There is an alchemy. Each of us carries a piece of experience relevant to this whole realm. I mean, everybody in different ways has their humanness, has their spirituality. You have heard different things in what we've all been saying. If we just sit for 15 minutes with three other people, and if those that want to speak will just say what they heard, what they were interested in, what in their own experience has come to the surface, the process of giving voice to it will be part of this purification. It will be part of the process. That's good to just to say it, to anchor it. You may hear something that is of interest and value. Trust me, this will be a good little 15-minute ways of it. It helps it metabolize itself to speak a little and listen. And you don't have to speak if you don't want to. But would the number people please stand up? We've got little cards with numbers. Give and pass the numbers out. You're going to get a number card, and there will be 11 little groups. And this side is Scott. You have the ones, right? Or you have the seven? Sevens. Okay. You're going to get a card with a number. The number ones will be here. One and move the chairs. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They're doing it. And then on this side, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. You will find the other people that have your number. And it will be better if we don't talk much while we do it. Sort of hold your number up. You get it? And move your chairs and sit down, and then we'll start the timing. Everybody has a number. Mm-hmm.